Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. Well, when was the last time you had an engaging conversation about insects? Well, we're about to talk about insects a lot with noted entomologist Michael Engel. He's going to discuss this passion of his. Michael is a research affiliate at the American Museum of Natural History in New York and University Distinguished Professor of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology, as well as Senior Curator of Entomology at the University of Kansas in Lawrence. He explores the topic of insects in a beautiful new book called Innumerable Insects, the story of the most diverse and myriad animals on Earth. He explores insects' evolution and diversity, metamorphosis, pests, parasites, plagues, camouflage, pollinations, and more. Michael Engel, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first off, I say that this is a beautiful book because it is. You have the most fascinating drawing of a praying mantis, if I'm not mistaken, on the cover of this book. Why did you choose praying mantis?
Well, that particular image just happens to be so striking with the praying mantis. It's a Malagasy species, and it has its raptorial arms spread to the heavens, if you will. And it's just a commanding image, and so hopefully will grab people's attention even from across a distant room.
Absolutely will. So, Michael, I'm curious about your story and where you got started in loving insects, because there's probably a story from when you were about 8 years old, and I love to hear these.
Well, I wish I could say most entomologists do have stories like that, and they were, you know, bug collectors since early childhood. I actually was not one of them. I certainly had a fascination for natural history and grew up in various places, including the Bay Area of California, and went about roaming around outside, but I was not a bug collector. And it wasn't until I got to college when a series of fortuitous events with various professors just kind of, if you will, the scales fell from my eyes and I realized my calling in entomology.
All right. And another quick question. I had to look it up because I've always been unclear between the word etymology, which is the study of words, and entomology, the study of insects. Do you ever get asked if you, you study words?
Yeah, or vice versa. They will refer to insects, but use the word etymology. It's quite commonly switched.
Lynn and I both love bees, and I was fascinated to learn that of the 20,000 species of bees, social behavior, which is one of the things that we like about bees, is really the exception of the bee world. There's only about 5% that are actually social, and the others are kind of off on their own.
Yeah, so most people think in terms of the charismatic honeybee or bumblebees, both of which are social. And honeybees, for example, account for only 7 species worldwide. And as you note, there's over 20,000 species of bees globally. And the vast majority of these are either solitary or even there's a large number that are cuckoos, much like a cuckoo bird who lay their egg nests of other bees.
Ah. Yeah, interesting. And then, of course, the other thing is, and I brought this up on the show before, but I guess I haven't gotten past it yet, but how do bumblebees fly? Because I've got these bushes outside my front door, these beautiful blue bushes, and there are a zillion honeybees in them during the late summer when these bushes bloom. And I'm looking at these fat little things, and I'm wondering, how do they get up into the air? How do they do it? Because, I mean, looking at your illustration of the various flying insects, I understand how they can fly, but the bumblebee still amazes me. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's a common misconception when people sort of say, oh, based upon aerodynamic principles, a bumblebee shouldn't be able to fly, when in fact that's actually a misapplication of aerodynamic principles. They attempt to apply the simple mathematics of, say, an airplane and then think, oh, this applies to a bumblebee, and sure enough, it wouldn't work out all that well, whereas bumblebee flight is perhaps more analogous to the flight of a helicopter. And when you apply those sorts of aerodynamic principles, there's absolutely no trouble with them getting into the air, as is evidenced by the fact that they're flying around us all the time.
Yeah. So as I look through your book, Michael, I feel like a child, which is really a cool feeling, because I flip through the pages with fascination at all of the drawings and also just the little tidbits of history that you bring in and the quotes from various people throughout history about insects. And I'm just so curious about how you decided to put it together in this way, because certainly the talk of insects could be perceived as sort of boring.
Yeah, well, the book sort of serves two purposes. On the one hand, it's telling the tale of insect evolution and diversity and all the amazing things that insects do and how vital they are to the survival of our planet. And on the other hand, it also attempts to tell a historical tale, mm-hmm. Little bits of trivia from the adventures of past explorers and those who made our original entomological discoveries. And it was a great opportunity to highlight these rare books that are now, you know, hard to come by and the public rarely ever sees. And the American Museum has an incredible treasure trove of rare books on insects, all of which are illustrated, you know, just with stunning illustrations. They're, you know, sublime artistic expressions. Of course, in the past, it wasn't so easy to run out and, you know, just take a quick photograph of a particular insect in order to document a particular scientific work. And so instead, they had to have trained artists who could render these insects as they were in life. And each of those artists put in their own artistic flair as well. And so they're incredible works of art. They're really quite stunning and quite, you know, many of them really capture you. And so it's a great opportunity to tell the tale of insect evolution and use these illustrations from the past from which those original discoveries were made.
Mm. And I hope you take my comment, it makes me feel like a child, as a compliment, because what it does is it inspires curiosity, and that's the best thing that we can come by as adults, really. I want to ask you about the discovery. So there's an estimated 5 million insects on the planet, but only about 1.1 million have been identified. So as an entomologist, I read that you've traveled to 40 different countries or something studying insects. Are you constantly finding new ones and naming them?
Yeah, it's a constant process. You know, it's very right to, you know, talk in the news about the discovery of a new bird or mammal in any given year, but thousands of new insect species are pouring in every year, and it's quite an overwhelming task to go out and document them. And new species are being found virtually everywhere, even right here in North America and, you know, seemingly well-trodden fields. You can find new species of insects, let alone the dozens that pour in or hundreds that pour in from tropical biodiversity hotspots, say, as Colombia or Borneo.
I've always known different types of grasshoppers, and I've lived around the country and I've seen different types of grasshoppers, but I didn't know very much about locusts. And they're basically, that I've learned in this book, they're grasshoppers that have become, you know, maybe too many grasshoppers in one space, and they take on this swarming mentality. Can you talk about that metamorphosis and just, you know, let's talk a little bit about locusts.
Yeah, locusts are quite fascinating. We have sort of a love-hate relationship with them because, of course, they come in, sweep in, and devour our crops. But their biology is quite intriguing, as well as a good model system for understanding how various environmental factors can trigger profound physiological and behavioral changes in an organism. And what happens is when they become overcrowded, and so they'll have tactile responses between individuals, and when those increase to a certain level whereby, you know, they're clearly bumping into one another more often, as well as perhaps the local food resources becoming slightly diminished, this triggers sort of a developmental change and physiological change within them, in which case they become more tolerant of those around them. Previously, they're a little more solitary in their behavior, so they become more gregarious. And then they will eventually begin these massive swarms where they will move en masse to a new locality where they can feed. And this will just continue on and form these massive, huge swarms. Ultimately, what we refer to as plague locusts, and that are so famous from history, particularly the biblical tales mm-hmm. of plagues that have descended upon Egypt and so forth.
Well, this metamorphosis is just fascinating. I was reading in your book about how their metabolism increases and they want to eat more and they want to have sex more so that they can so they can procreate and all of this happens and then they just become this giant unit of 1 or 2 billion flying grasshoppers that are wreaking havoc on the countryside.
Yeah, it's quite amazing, and sometimes these massive swarms can get picked up by air currents, carried off to places where they didn't intend to, and get dumped, for example, upon a glacier. And so you can actually go back and look at a sort of the fossil record, sub-fossil record, if you will, of plague swarms, because they will accidentally get frozen in the ice. And as you go down through the various layers, you can date when certain swarms were taking place by the deposition, a literal layer of locust deposited in the ice.
And I read that, so you get this big swarm that's in the air, and let's say they're heading towards a field, and it's on the seaside, or it's on the coast somewhere, and a large wind picks up and just blows them out to sea and into that glacier or out to sea, and that's the end of it, right?
Indeed. It most fortuitously for those whose crops were sitting there by the seashore.
Absolutely. So, humans are pretty boring when it comes to how we communicate. We do it mostly with words, simple words. But insects are fascinating how they communicate with, chemical cues and vibration and many other ways. Can you talk about, your favorite couple of insects in their modes of communication?
Yeah, insect communication takes every imaginable form, from chemical communication, as you mentioned, such as simple pheromones, but all the way through every imaginable substrate and form of communication. Some of my favorites, of course, are the flashes of fireflies, the very characteristic lights that they produce at night. And it's not just the particular light color, but it's also the pattern in which the light moves, in which they can identify their mates. But perhaps the ultimate expression in terms of insect communication is also one of the most remarkable forms of communication on this planet. And it it's a form of communication that's only evolved twice, once in us, humans, and then once in honeybees. And that is an abstract language. And honeybees are the only other organism on this planet known to use an abstract language. And what they will do is they will use an abstract series of movements, which we call the waggle dance. And this allows one worker to convey to another worker the location and distance and direction of a particular resource. And so they can very effectively communicate between themselves where a pollen resource may be or where they need to go to establish a new nest. And it's just an absolutely fascinating form of communication.
That is. Hey, since you mentioned fireflies, I guess it ties into maybe a story about climate change, because as someone who's lived in the northern latitudes for most of my life, whenever I've gone to the south or somewhere, well, I think it's in the south, at lower latitudes where I see fireflies, it's absolutely amazing. But I have heard that here in Utah, people have started to see fireflies in the summer. Can you talk about that and how it does tie into climate change?
Yeah, climate change is having a dramatic impact on species everywhere, and insects in particular. Insects are quite responsive to changes in climate, both negatively and positively. And so in response to changing climates, depending upon a particular species threshold, they will either contract or expand their distribution. And so, as you mentioned, species that were previously limited in how far they could go based upon the duration and severity of winters or something, and are unfortunately changing climate that is around us, they are able to expand and move their distributions northward, southward, whichever way the new thresholds map out for them. And in the worst, this impacts, you know, beneficial species such as, you know, the aforementioned bees that we talked about. You know, these are critical pollinators. Every third bite of food that we take is the result of animal pollination, be it a bee or a butterfly or a beetle. And through climate change, as well as overuse of pesticides and habitat fragmentation, many of our critical pollinators are contracting their distributions and becoming less abundant. Some of the most famous examples are among some of the bumblebees of the western United States, where they're becoming harder and harder to find. But then, you know, on the other side of the coin, we have disease-carrying mosquitoes and their lot who are being able to expand their distributions into areas where they previously had been eradicated or where they had never occurred before.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Michael Engel in his book, Natural History's Innumerable Insects, the Story of the Most Diverse and Myriad Animals on the Earth. And in, as Lynn mentioned, it features illustrations from a great rare book, a series of book collections, and so the illustrations are beautiful. Michael, I read a book some time ago, and I'm trying to think who wrote it, and it was on synchronicity, and it was, you know, for an example, a dad is laying on the couch sleeping, and his child is on his chest sleeping as well, and their two heartbeats will sync up, you know, those sorts of things. And the author was telling the story of being on a boat as the sun was going down somewhere in Africa, and there were a bunch of lightning bugs that were starting to fire their lights to attract mates or to communicate in some fashion. And in the beginning, it was random and chaotic patterns of flashes. And then over time, as the sun went down and it became darker, the ones that were slower sped up a little bit, and the ones that were faster slowed down a little bit. And within an hour, there was one big synchronous flash on, flash off. And I don't know if you've heard that before or if you know of any other examples of synchronicity in the insect world.
Yeah, it's amazing the ways, and this is another aspect of their incredible communication. And there are other examples of this. And one that comes to mind right away is in sort of the higher elevations of Southeast Asia and Central Asia, there are a species of honeybee called Apis dorsata, which is the giant honeybee. It's many times larger than the typical honeybee that we think of. And unlike our honeybee that nests in cavities, and so the comb is hidden away inside of a tree hole or, you know, within the managed hive that we're more familiar with, they nest in the open, and they build these large combs, usually from an overhanging cliff or from a, you know, sturdy branch of a tree. And then the comb is covered by the bees. They form sort of a curtain, if you will, covering that comb. And if you go up and they begin to be disturbed, many times they will give warning flashes. And so they'll move their body and their wings in a certain particular pattern. And through time, very quickly, this becomes sort of a synchronized series of movements. And it seems as though the bees are moving in sort of a wave across the entirety of this comb surface. And so it's a great example of how they, too, can also synchronize themselves within a very short period of time to send out, in this case, sort of a warning communication, like, back off, leave us alone.
Oh, fascinating. I love all the illustrations, although I still got creeped out a little bit when I look at the lice and when I look at some of the roaches. And I read in your book that in Madagascar, there are hissing roaches. What's that all about?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, they are native from Madagascar, but they are actually quite popular. So if you go to your average insect zoo in North America, or even many times some classrooms, they may have a Madagascar hissing cockroach. And These roaches actually will take in air into their body, and then through a series of holes that line the abdomen, they can push that air out, and it forms a characteristic hissing sound. And so when they're disturbed, they will very quickly kind of give a quick hiss in order to let the individual who's disrupting them know, you know, please leave me alone, you know, please try and stay away. And they use it in other forms of communication amongst themselves, but primarily we think of it in terms of the alarm that they give off when they're disturbed.
Hmm. Wow, that's pretty fascinating. I could fixate on these kinds of, well, cockroaches, fleas, lice. You know, you have a lot of, well, you devote an entire chapter to those bugs that are parasites, and the ones that really bother our well-being, mosquitoes. But I'm going to stick with the positive side for a moment. You know, a few minutes ago, you said every third bite of food is made possible by insects, which is a great takeaway from this book. Another really positive and amazing things that I didn't know is that insects were the first to fly. Can you talk about the origin and evolution of flight?
Yeah, insects probably are not given enough credit. They invented many things before, certainly before humans, and even before many other lineages of animal. And so, as you note, they were the first to fly, they were the first to sing, they were the first to evolve societies, they were the first to evolve agriculture, animal husbandry, language, and so forth. But flight is perhaps one of those most remarkable of traits. And so insects took to the skies about 410 million years ago. That's an incredibly long period of time. And when you look at the flight of a bumblebee or a butterfly or a beetle, you're looking at the summation of 400 million years of evolution's refinement of flight among insects. And insect flight was taking place 170 million years before any other lineage of animals took to the air. And so the ones that immediately followed them, well, immediately, 170 million years later, followed them would have been the pterosaurs, and then eventually they were followed by birds and bats. And so it's pretty incredible that this panoply of species that we see around us that are flying around every day have been doing so since time immemorial.
Wow. That's pretty fascinating. Final question for you. I've always wondered, what would the world be like without mosquitoes? They wreak so much havoc around the world with the spreading of disease. But why do we need them?
Well, insects, mosquitoes in particular, get a little bit of a bad rap. Not all of them are disease vectors. And again, no insect causes disease. In fact, disease is caused by, you know, bacteria, protozoans, viruses, and so forth. And the insect is merely transmitting it from one to another. And so not all mosquitoes are transmitting disease to humans. For those that are, we can sometimes wonder, well, the world will be better off without them. But in fact, in some places, mosquitoes are a great source of food for species that we definitely want to keep around. For example, there are species of bats that feed extensively upon mosquitoes. So they help control the mosquito population for us and at the same time are sustaining themselves. And of course, these bats, then some of them are pollinators and they serve other roles in the ecosystem. And so we certainly don't want to impact species like that. So even seemingly, you know, noxious or annoying insects are integrated into life in such a way that if you pull them out of the network, there are unintended consequences that can ripple on elsewhere that we certainly don't want to take place.
A good affirmation. The book is Innumerable Insects, the Story of the Most Diverse and Myriad Animals on Earth. Our guest is Michael Engel. Michael, thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.